This podcast is brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Keep Joy on air by becoming a member, a subscriber, or donate. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.
Bored of too many ads and dull, meaningless chat? We've got neither. Joy Drive, smart, fun radio.
We all know the feeling. You know, when we're stressed, I certainly find it hard to focus on anything. It's like my mind is, I suppose, hijacked is a good word for it. So when we're in this state, how do we get out of it and get back on with our lives? Well, there's such a thing known as the stress cycle. I don't know what it is. I don't like the sound of it. And if I'm in it, I want to know how to get out of it. Well, Teresa Larkin is an Associate Professor of Medical Sciences at the University of Wollongong and joins us. Teresa, welcome to Joy Drive.
Thank you. How are you?
I'm well, thank you. Now, when is it, why is it that when we're stressed, we can't seem to focus on anything else?
Yeah, that's a great question and a good example of what's happening in your brain, actually. So when we're stressed, that high level of ongoing chronic sort of elevated cortisol, it actually does affect different parts of your brain. And one of the first parts of your brain that's activated, even in an initial fight or flight or stress response, is the amygdala. And so that's really responsible for our panic and anxiety and our fear modes. You know, it's saying need to be heightened on alert, you know, something bad might be happening. But that's also where we then have our more emotional and reactive responses come from. So in different books, people might refer to that as more the primitive brain. Whereas our frontal cortex, so part of our cortex, which is our sort of higher order thinking, it's really responsible for goal-directed, rational thinking. You know, we have higher order control of our thoughts. And during chronic stress, the activity in that is reduced. So we don't think as clearly because we don't have access to our more rational thinking processes. We're more driven by emotions and reactivity.
So it's like this frontal cortex. It's like it almost goes offline when we're stressed.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, that's right. So we have a reduction in our activity there. And that's because I suppose when we're stressed, we do go back to primitive functions. We're thinking about saving ourselves. You know, we're thinking about what's happening. There's a fight or flight situation. I need to conserve energy. I need to, you know, be able to respond. And our higher order thinking, you know, analyzing situations, thinking clearly, all of those things are not really essential in an immediate acute stress situation. So you're right. It kind of is like it goes offline.
Why is stress so unhealthy? We hear that all the time, but just how bad is it for us?
So, you know, we all experience stress and it's definitely a part of our life. It's inevitable. And so we do have a stress response that's healthy, you know, in the same way that if you're sitting on the lounge and you see something dark behind you and you think it's a huntsman and you're scared of huntsman spiders, you know, we first perceive the threat and that's the amygdala. And then that middle part is really about the fight or flight response. And that's to get us moving or to be able to, you know, spring us into action. And that's essential. But then we often move from that quickly if it's something like, you know, a spider's there, but then you think, oh, it's not a spider. It's just, you know, a piece of fluff or whatever. And so you have that relief. And we've all experienced when we have that hit of adrenaline, you know, you can feel it in your heart. You can feel everything going faster and then it subsides. And it's actually important that we do things to have a stress response fairly regularly so that then if we do have a situation where we really need to go into fight or flight, the body can adapt. The problem is when we remain in that chronic stress fight or flight response. And that's because ongoing high cortisol is not healthy for our brain or for our body. So in a short term, that's fine. You know, this release of adrenaline and cortisol is there so that we can mobilize our energy stores in case we did have to run from that huntsman spider or whatever. But ongoing, you know, chronic stress and high cortisol, they can increase inflammation and that's very damaging for our brain and organs. It also has those effects that we just spoke about on the brain. You know, it reduces the activity in the frontal and prefrontal cortex. It can even shrink the hippocampus, which is essential for memory. So yeah, ongoing cortisol isn't good. And then if we have ongoing release of glucose because the brain's thinking, oh my gosh, you know, we might need to run at any moment, then that's also bad for our other organs. So yeah, that's why ongoing stress is not good for us.
Can our brains, you mentioned it can shrink a little bit with chronic stress and high levels of cortisol. Do we recover from that if we get it under control? Or once it's shrunk for good and we lose that bit of memory?
So, yeah, the only part it really shrinks is just that hippocampus, right, which is okay. A small part of the brain. So it won't shrink overall the brain. But, you know, there can be ongoing effects in the brain from chronic stresses, and especially if that's something like a traumatic stress. But there definitely are things that we can do to help reverse that. So there are activities that we can do that can help reverse shrinking of the hippocampus, that can increase blood flow back to the prefrontal cortex for better thinking, that can reduce inflammation. So there are things that we can do to lower our stress response and then lower those negative effects of ongoing high cortisol.
It sounds like, Teresa, is it almost like, you know, like being late for work might trigger a stress response in some people, but it's not the same as being lunch for a hungry tiger, is it? So is it almost like because this frontal cortex is offline, we aren't able to give a bit of an objective risk assessment and say, you know what, I'm not going to die because I'm 5 minutes late for work. It might not look good, but no big deal. Is it like we can't do that assessment and therefore, you know, reduce the stress correspondingly?
Yeah, that's a really great way of thinking of it, and that is true. And the other thing is that when we're in this constant fight or flight and high cortisol, it actually means that we're more responsive to an increase in adrenaline. So that even if you did just have that little thing like, oh my gosh, I'm going to be late for this meeting, your body does respond more. It's more like it's more sensitive to that little leap in adrenaline. Whereas if we weren't in a stress situation, if you were the most relaxed you can ever be and you thought you were going to be late for work, it doesn't seem as big a problem, does it, as when you're already stressed and you've already got lots of things going on and you're already thinking, I've got that thing due and, you know, I'm not sure if I spoke to someone the right way or whatever. Then another little thing on top, the being late for work or a meeting or something, seems so much bigger. So, yeah, exactly like what you said, part of it's to do with the already reduced activity in the areas of our brain that help us think clearly, on top of the fact that then we're more sensitive to any spike in adrenaline that we get just through even normal activities.
So in the same way, does that mean like small stresses, like not so much phobias like, you know, snakes for me or spiders, huntsman spiders, etc. But is it true that small stresses can accumulate and therefore, you know, if you do get the last stress, the final stress on this, you know, you've got 20 of them happening at once, is you're going to be late for that meeting, which is no big deal. Is that why we also therefore overreact or to that particular stress?
That's definitely right. So, yeah, so when we're sort of at our capacity of stress and load and things like that, then a small thing on top just seems too much because that's a bit of an adrenaline spike and we really, yeah, we sort of overestimate what that means. And that's where things like, which is probably a different topic, but that's where things like burnout come in terms of a lot of people experience burnout to do with work stresses, but also other, you know, commitments in their life and other worries. But the burnout is kind of a case of this chronic stress because it's often work associated where there's just extra work, extra demands, you know, not enough people, working too much around the clock. All those things really do add up. So you're right. And then put that on top of, you know, having stresses at home or with your health or someone else's health. That's where we really can have these compounding impacts.
We're chatting with Teresa Larkin, Associate Professor of Medical Sciences at the University of Wollongong, about ways we can, I suppose, I don't like the word snap out of the stress cycle, but it is, it's ending the stress cycle, isn't it? Or exiting the stress cycle and avoiding burnout. Now, just, I want to talk about something that we hear about a lot, Teresa, and that is self-soothing. Is that a good tool to have, I suppose, if we have a toolkit that, you know, we can open the box and say, okay, I'm in one of these heightened stress states, my frontal cortex is offline, I need to do something to get my levels of stress down immediately?
The thing that I love, and this is in our conversation article, is that the five ways that we talk about, there's kind of something in there for everyone. And so you're right, self-soothing is one of those tools that you can have in your toolbox. But the other four include exercise, cognitive activities like writing things down or journaling, creative activities, and social activities. So, and self-soothing activities, they're usually just you on your own. So I feel like there's something in that for everyone. There's people who like to exercise, who like to write, heaps of different creative outlets, people who would prefer to go to others to help them de-stress, but others who prefer to be on their own and do something like a meditation or breathing activities or crying at a sad movie, because that's also one of the self-soothing activities.
Oh, we do.
And when
that.
We talk about them in terms of getting us out of the cycle, one way to think about it is that lots of people have stresses that are not going to disappear by going for a run. So the key with it, though, is that we can have stresses that can be ongoing. You know, you might be worried about someone else's health or your health or something that you can't control. But what these things do, and to help us sort of get out of that stress cycle, is that they reduce the intensity of what we're feeling. And I think sometimes people can be a bit resistant to that because they think, but I've still got this stress. I still need to worry about it. And I guess a good way to think about it is that analogy of the oxygen mask in an aeroplane. You know, you've got to put yours on first before you can help others. So reducing our stress response and fight or flight with these activities that can bring us back down, it means that we are better people. We're better able to respond, which means that we're better to others. We're better able to help others and ourselves, even though those stresses might still be there. So it's just helping the health of our brain and our body, and then societal health.
Teresa, really interesting conversation. What struck me is of the five things we can do to get out of that stress cycle, they're often the things that we don't do when we're stressed and busy, aren't they? They're things like, I haven't got time to watch a movie, or I haven't got time to go to the gym and exercise. They're almost, we're cutting out the things that we need to do.
It's so true. And, you know, they say that scrolling on social media trying to distract yourself, it doesn't work, because it's not actually getting to the crux of the biology of what's happening in the stress cycle. So you're right. And this is where I think it's a really, sometimes it's nice to read these things again. You know, we all know that exercise could help, or that, you know, a meditation can help, but sometimes it's nice to just read them again and really know that, I guess with this article, it was really highlighting the science behind it. And it's absolutely right. You know, when you're the most stressed, you just think you cannot possibly go for a run or a walk or a bike ride for half an hour, but it is the best thing for you. Or that you think, I can't take time out to meditate, or, you know, I don't have time to sit on the couch and do some knitting or make some craft or art or music or whatever it is. Or, you know, you don't want to be with someone else and have time to socialize, but they're so beneficial, you know, for bringing us out of that stress response. And the big benefit is that then we're going to be more effective and efficient in what we do anyway. So it's a good use of our time.
Teresa, great conversation. Thank you so much for having it with us on Joy Drive.
Thank you. Have a nice evening.
Thank you. Teresa Larkin, the Associate Professor of Medical Sciences at the University of Wollongong.
Joy Drive on Joy 94.9 FM in Melbourne, Joy on your digital radio, iHeartRadio, TuneIn.com or the Joy app, no matter where you are. Thanks for listening to another Joy podcast brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Help keep Joy on air. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.